So I actually went back and retitled my sermons. I don't know how many of you pay that close attention to the recordings online, but in chapter 4, we looked at kingdom parables, and since then, I think there is a very consistent and strong kingdom theme through the actions that Jesus is doing as he's teaching about the kingdom. And he's pretty much just showing through his actions, through what he does and doesn't do, that he's teaching the truths about the kingdom, and as we talked about before, these truths are in opposition to the Roman kingdom, the Roman Empire, because Rome also used the word euangelion or gospel to consistently preach about their empire and how they were spreading good news, spreading their empire, spreading peace in their way. And we've talked about how the book of Mark is effectively a competing gospel, a competing kingdom. In chapter 4, we looked at the kingdom parables, and as we've gone from there, we saw first in chapter 5, we saw him show his power, or show the power of the kingdom, through his power over the agents of chaos, which were sea, demons, and death. And we've talked about in the cultural background of the day, in order for a kingdom to establish itself, it has to conquer the chaos around it. Because this is a big ancient theme of order versus chaos, and the leaders, the empires, were to establish order. And Jesus, through his conquering of the sea, demons, and death, shows that he has the power to bring in the kingdom. And then, as we move on from there, he showed himself as the promised leader. As we looked into chapter 6, he showed that he is the promised leader of the kingdom, and he showed this through his authority, his power, and his compassion, and his provision. And we saw how all of these, very purposefully by the crafting of Mark, as he does a flashback to the horrid banquet of Herod that led to the death of John the Baptist, we saw that these leadership and these kingdom, kingship, shepherd principles and values that Jesus is championing and living out and fulfilling right in front of the people stand in such stark contrast to what Herod, who called himself the king of the Jews, and as the king of Jews through Old Testament and New Testament imagery stands as a shepherd of the people, we saw how these two just stood in such stark contrast to each other, that Jesus had come to fulfill the promises and be the leader that was needed, and that was such a big theme in Isaiah, that this leadership, this greater shepherd, this greater deliverer is so needed. So Mark uses that flashback to Herod to show how far the people and the leadership had come and how much Jesus was needed. So he showed first and foremost the power to bring in the kingdom, and then he showed that he is the leader of the kingdom. And now as we look to 7:1 through 8:21, we are going to see the next phase of this teaching through action as he teaches about who it is that is and composes the people of the kingdom. And as we look here, we're going to start the first section that we're going to look at is 7:1 through 23, and that is what was read, so I'm not going to reread it, but we will work through it. And you read at the beginning, now when Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem. So we are immediately brought into his conflict that we've read about before with these Pharisees and some coming from Jerusalem. We saw this back in chapter 3, and we saw that some of the Pharisees and the leaders by this point already are working with the Herodians, and we talked about the only reason that they would do that, because those two groups really do not get along, the only reason they do that is that the Herodians had the ear of Herod, who has the permission of Rome, through getting approval, to do a death sentence. The Jews at this time did not have the ability to do that. So in order to get that chain of events to happen, they'd have to work with the Herodians. So we know that this is a very animistic conflict that he is dealing with here. The question that they bring, though, is not as direct of an attack, because we talked about back in chapter 3 how their question or their claim that he's doing these things through the power of Beelzebul or the power of Satan, that claim would have been a death sentence if that's true, because according to Old Testament law, if a false teacher comes in and is a false prophet and is leading people away to the powers of darkness, to Satan, that they are to kill that false prophet, to purge out the evil from among them. So by their own law, they could start that chain of events to lead to his death. That is not what is being attacked here. That's not the question. The question just comes in kind of what they're seeing. They notice that some of Jesus' disciples eat with defiled or unwashed hands. And if you're here last week or you look back just a few verses earlier at the end of chapter 6, you read just those last couple verses here starting in 55, and ran about the whole region and began to bring the sick. So like all the crowds that are gathering him, they bring the sick people on their beds to wherever they heard that he was, and whenever he came in villages, cities, or countryside, they laid the sick in the marketplace and implored him that they might touch even the fringe of the garment, and as many touched him as were well. So you have crowds of sick, you have marketplace, you have touching of garments. Like, these are all things that are important in the Jewish culture and ritual and purity laws. So as chapter 6 ended, we read that Jesus and his disciples were in the marketplace with these crowds of sick people pressing in even to touch the fringe of his garment, which means that like all of him and his disciples are all, according to Jewish ritual, contaminated, if you will, because they've been in contact in the marketplace here. And Mark explains to his Roman audience, and to us, helpfully, that the Pharisees and all the Jews would not eat after they had come from the marketplace until they had washed their hands. So they ask Jesus why his disciples don't follow this tradition of the elders. Now, it is important, and it is very helpful here, that it is specified in the text that this is a tradition of the elders. This is not specified as why don't they follow Old Testament law, why don't they follow Mosaic law. This is why don't they follow the tradition of the elders. Because as these practices, the specific washing and a lot of the things that Mark just mentioned in that what's probably a parenthetical phrase in your Bible, these practices go well beyond what is specified anywhere in the Old Testament. We have to remember that the Pharisees and the religious leaders were convinced that the nation had been exiled and was still being punished. We've talked about this before, how the leaders and the people viewed themselves still in exile. They're still under Roman dominion. Caleb went through the end of the Old Testament and how really only two tribes had come back, so there's still 10 lost tribes. The people very much feel that they're still in exile. The religious leaders especially convinced that the nation had been exiled and was still being punished because they had not been holy or followed God's law enough. So they added lots of traditional and additional instructions on top of the Old Testament laws and principles to ensure holiness. It was their way of trying to make sure they got back into God's good grace and good favor so that the exile could come to an end. So I think there are times when we give the Pharisees and leaders a bit too hard of a time because their intentions, at least at a beginning point, were good. They're seeking to purify a people, restore law-abiding practices, and to honor God. And the way they've done that is pile on pile on pile traditions of the elders. And this is not the first time that Jesus has started to point out that you've kind of done so to an absurd extent. And you've forgotten the whole point, like this whole beginning principle or law you started with and you added a bunch of stuff, you kind of forgot the whole point of it somewhere along the way. And the Old Testament principle at play here is that Israel was supposed to be separate from and not like the other nations. Like, you can go look at a lot of verses that talk about that principle. And by this time, one of the applications of that principle, so again, not the law, not the principle, this is a tradition, one of the applications of that was that they washed their hands after going to the marketplace where Gentiles and Jews mingled together. So it is a way of them giving a specific application and instruction to that principle. In response to their question, he tells them that they are hypocrites, just as Isaiah spoke against. They honor God with their lips, but their hearts are far from him. They worship in vain, teaching as doctrines the commandment of men. And you should pay close attention to how that's worded, teaching as doctrine the commandments of men. Teaching as doctrine, teaching as what God's law was and what he intended and what its purpose was, the commandments, the additional instructions chosen and formulated and written by men. And he's saying, you're giving priority to what is written by people and not what is written by God. You've reversed this from what it was supposed to be. He then gives an example that shows this reversal. The law says to honor your father and mother. So that's law. That's the starting point. But they taught that anything set aside as korban, fancy word for dedicated or offered to God. So this is something that you would have and you would say, this is something that I am sacrificing and giving to the temple and the priests and the leaders here. It is no longer mine. I'm giving it over to God and to the service in the temple. And you say that anything that is in that category is not permitted to be used even if that person's father or mother is in need, thus making how you interpret the law more important than the heart of the law. Because how Jesus, and this isn't in the text, but reading between the lines here, how Jesus would have that specific application play out is that, okay, yes, you did dedicate that to the temple, to me, but that is something that your parents are currently in need of, and I have commanded you to honor your parents and mother and make sure that you provide for them. That's one of the main principles here in this culture, is that a lot of times the children would provide for the parents as the parents are aging. And Jesus is saying, if you're so concerned about the rules and the regulations of stuff that is dedicated to my temple that you've missed the heart of how you treat one another, You're doing the opposite of what I commanded you to do. And you flip the whole system by how you're applying it. We need to go back to the heart. Calling the people then to himself, he declared that it is not things outside a person, but inside a person that defile them, which again was the whole point of the purity laws. The purity laws were to give practical application to heart values and beliefs. They were a way of living out your beliefs and your principles in your culture. Later, the disciples ask him about the parable, which is kind of funny, because you read that he called the people to himself, said, "Hear me, all of you, and understand, there is nothing outside a person that going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him." It's not a parable. It's just a statement, a fact. And they come to him like, what is this parable? What does this mean? What's the secret meaning here? And he's like, it is what I said. So it's kind of interesting here that they ask about a parable, and then disappointed in their lack of understanding, he clarifies that what goes into a person does not defile them because it does not touch the heart. What has God been concerned most and first and foremost all along? What does David call the man after God's own heart? God's always been most concerned about the heart. The things that go into a person don't defile them because they don't touch the heart, but what comes out of them can show the defilement of their heart, and that is what God is most concerned about. And then Mark adds a comment about how Jesus, with this, declares all food clean. And that happens more explicitly later to Peter in Acts chapter 10 in a vision to Peter. But this comment paves the way for that vision. And it's also interesting that both use food laws and contact, physical contact, as a segue into Gentile inclusion. Because that's actually where we're going next in the text. And that's not on accident. Before we continue, though, I want to reframe Jesus' interaction with the religious leaders. In his response, I believe what he is essentially saying is the kingdom is arriving right in front of you, and you're worried about what it comes into contact with? The point of all the purity laws wasn't so that you could keep yourself physically clean, but so that you could be a holy nation, a kingdom of priests, bearing witness to God so that the nations might be drawn to him and enjoy God's blessings through you. It was never just about outside purity. It was about inward purity and witness. If this is how you're applying principles about the Gentiles, you've missed the point completely. In fact, if you were here for my sermons as we went through a few years ago in Exodus and Leviticus, I took time to show that the vast majority of the purity laws were only in place because of what the specific practice did or did not say about one's morality and belief about God in that culture at that time. The laws were not laws simply for the sake of laws. They were a living out in that culture of the Ten Commandments. They were a compilation of wisdom, principles, and practices so that the people would look, live, believe, and think like people who embodied the heart of the Ten Commandments, the heart of God. That's why when Jesus is asked about, well, what's the most important commandment? It's like, well, let me remind you where this was all supposed to start. Love God, love others. Now do that in your culture. If you lose the heart of the laws, it doesn't matter how you apply them anymore because you've lost the whole point of the laws. And that's what he's pointing out here to the leaders. One of the major points of the law, by the way, was to preserve the purity and love for God in the nation that was to be the conduit through which God would bless the whole world. Remember the promise to Abraham? Through your seed, all of the world, all the peoples will be blessed. If we're this worried about separating and cleansing ourselves and washing our hands of the Gentiles, I think we've forgotten the original promise, guys. The nation was to be the conduit through which God would bless the whole world. If you look at the promises of the new kingdom, the new Exodus, the coming of the Messiah, and the time of restoration, in all of those promises, there is always included the promise that the nations will be included. In fact, it is not an accident that Jesus grew up and ministered mostly in the multicultural region of Galilee and the surrounding areas, Jewish and Gentiles alike. For in Isaiah 9, the "unto us is a child born" passage that we're all pretty familiar with, the introduction, the verses that aren't so well in that area, the introduction to those verses reads like this. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, which, if you don't remember Israel geography, these are the northern tribes in the same region that is the current day in Jesus' time, Galilee. And they often first took the first brunt of punishment being brought in because a lot of the empires came in from the north, and they hit the northern tribes first. So he says, in the former times, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. So you can read that. In the former times, he brought into contempt Galilee. But in the latter times, he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. In other words, he's saying the land that first took the punishment is going to be the land that first sees the restoration for here and all nations. It is not an accident that Jesus was born and ministered in Galilee and the northern areas primarily. That is fulfillment of Isaiah 9. To make this point even more clear, Jesus then leaves where he is and begins to minister in Gentile areas to the north. Jesus heads north into the Gentile region of Tyre and Sidon. And I need to flip a page in my Bible as we read the next few verses. Starting in verse 24, we're going to read 24 to 30. And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. And we've seen that before. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, let the children be fed first, for it is not right for the children's bread to be thrown to the dogs. But she answered him, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And he said to her, for this statement you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter. And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. So Jesus next, after this conflict with the leaders, heads north into the Gentile region of Tyre and Sidon. And if you look at a map, it's just pretty much we're going north. Once there, a Gentile woman arrives and begs him to cast a demon out of her daughter. He responds, let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Now I've always heard this as a great insult and a racist slur, calling her a dog. But after some more research, there is an aspect of that, but I don't think we should see it as strong of an insult as you might think. Dog was a common and severe ancient insult, as dogs are scavengers in many cultures, and Jews did at times call Gentiles the racial slur of dog, and they shouldn't have. But the word here is not the same word that is used for the unclean wild dog, but rather a word that means little dog, house dog, or lap dog. It's a diminutive form of the word. If you go through, and I did a quick one on my Bible software, if you go through all the Greek uses of the word dog, there is a different form that is used every time it is referring to wild dogs or scavenger dog, or it's used in an insulting form. This is the different form. This is like a domesticated dog form. And dogs in this area where he now is, in this Hellenized area of Greek culture, it was quite common at the time to keep house dogs that would fall into this category. So some may still have heard an insult here, but the metaphor itself is the bigger point. The children, the ones for whom the bread was intended first, get to eat first. And in response, she says, well, yeah, that's true, but the dogs also get the crumbs. And for this statement, he says, your daughter is healed. So what just happened in this exchange? It is made even more clear in Matthew's account. But I think one layer of what just happened is that Jesus is acting out the Jews' misunderstanding about the Messiah and God's kingdom. In the Matthew account, this is a longer event, and he at first ignores her as she calls, and he won't respond. Just as the Jews ignore the Gentiles. Then he says that he has come for the house of Israel, and the bread goes to them first, like they thought the kingdom was for them. In his exchange, then, what he is effectively asking is, do you think the benefits of the kingdom are for you as well? She's like, well, yeah, I do. And if we could at least get the crumbs, that'd be great. And he agrees. Through this, her great faith is demonstrated, effectively saying, I know you came for your people first, that you are fulfilling God's promises to them, but if we can get even the crumbs of what you're offering, it will be enough. Another layer is that Jesus is acting out 1 Kings 17. Where Elijah, persecuted by the king of Israel, as Jesus is persecuted by the religious leaders, flees to the area of Sidon. Where did we just read that Jesus is? In the area of Tyre and Sidon. And Elijah asks a widow to feed him first with the last bread that she has to survive on, and if she has the faith to do so, flour and oil will not run out until the drought is over. She does, and has bread for many days. In that story, a little bread turns into an abundance through faith. This theme is going to continue as just a few verses after this exchange, where a Gentile woman asks for just the breadcrumbs of what Jesus has to offer, we're going to read of him multiplying bread to feed thousands of Gentiles, just as he had done for the Israelites. The next thing we read is in 7:31 to 37. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment. And they begged him to lay his hand on them. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears and after spitting, touched his tongue and looked up to heaven. And he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, and that is, be opened. And his ears were opened and his tongue was released and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one, but the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed, as always. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. So from the region of Tyre and Sidon, Jesus travels next back to the Decapolis, where he has been before. And we remember geographically, the Decapolis is on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, and it's a primarily Gentile area, but with Jewish communities in it. So he travels here, and the last time he was here, he healed a man who was possessed by a legion of unclean spirits. And that's one of the only people that he has given permission to go and spread the word. And it seems like this guy did a pretty good job. Because as Jesus lands, people come to him, and they bring to him a man who is deaf and not able to speak clearly. Not wanting to make a show of it, Jesus takes him aside privately to heal him. Now, there is a cultural aspect of what's going on here with this taking aside and healing privately. Because remember how back when Jesus healed the unclean spirits, the legions, and he cast them out, the people were afraid immediately. And effectively, one of the cultural aspects of that fear is like, whoa, big powerful magician just showed up and we're not sure who this is, by whose authority you are, and we're not sure if we like you because you just messed up our economy by getting rid of a whole herd of pigs. So could you leave? And he leaves, but he leaves a guy to spread the word that the Lord has done this. Because he doesn't want the word to be, oh, a powerful magician came and did this thing. He's like, no, the Lord came here and did something. So what he doesn't want to give these people here is the big showy, flashy magician incantation and all sorts of fancy stuff going on. He doesn't want to feed into that mentality. It's like, no, I'm going to privately do a miracle, and then they can go and see the evidence of it, but I'm not going to make a show of it. So Jesus then, as you read here, and you might be surprised by what he does, takes him aside, puts his finger in his ears, or fingers in his ears, so like kind of puts both fingers in his ears, then after spitting, touches his tongue and looks up to heaven. And you're like, what? What you need to remember here is that the guy's deaf. He can't hear anything Jesus says. So what Jesus does is he culturally acts out what he is going to do. Because spit or spittle was actually commonly held as having healing properties and was part of some magic incantations that people would do. But you read immediately afterwards that he looked up to heaven. Because what he's doing is touching ears, touching tongue, using spit, saying healing, ears, tongues, looking up to God, saying God is going to heal your ears and your tongue. He just acted it out for the guy because he couldn't hear him. And I just think that's beautiful. God communicating to him in a way that he would understand. So Jesus acts this out and says, I'm going to heal your hearing and your speaking, and then looks up to specify that this isn't magic, this is from God. And then he sighs, which I think is a beautiful parallelism to what we've seen earlier in Israelite territory. He sighs, which is a groan of great sorrow and mourning over the pain of the Gentiles, just as he had done with the pain of the Israelites. And he says a simple command, be opened. Just like he's always done, no fancy incantations, no big, long rigmarole thing, no appealing to all sorts of long list of higher powers, just be opened. Looks at the sea, be still. Looks at an unclean spirit, get out. And that's all he has to say. The people, when they see that this man is healed, are astonished, saying he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. Now, it's interesting that the text actually switches here, because the text has been very specific, saying that this man had a speech impediment, that he couldn't speak clearly. He was not technically speaking mute. There's a different reason for this switch here, because there are two important allusions in this closing statement here by these people. First, he has done all things well. Very likely purposely sounds an awful lot like it is good from Genesis 1. An allusion back to creation theme. We've talked about this a lot in Mark already, this constant returning to creation, recreation theme. Second, the healing of the deaf and the mute brings us right back to the same section of Isaiah that opened the chapter by alluding to a a section in chapter 29, which is literally the chapter that he had referred to earlier. So Mark is beautifully saying, hey, you remember that thing that he alluded to earlier that might be still on your mind? Yeah, let's go right back there. And in Isaiah 29 and 32 and 35, there are passages where the healing of the deaf and the mute is associated with the coming of the promised king and the kingdom and the fulfillment of the messianic promises, including people from all nations turning to God. This is a beautiful full circle that just happened with Isaiah allusions. And then from there, we go on into chapter 8. And this is the second miraculous feeding account, the feeding of the 4,000. In those days, when again a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd, because they have been with me now for 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from far away. And his disciples answered, how can one feed these people with bread here in a desolate place? What just happened a couple chapters ago? I mean, like, I know it's been longer than a couple chapters in their life. Like, it's been time. But you can't read that and look at the disciples and be like, he's done it before. But they're again, baffled. Like, how are we going to feed all the people here? And he asked them, how many loaves do you have? And they said, 7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples and set them before the people, and they set them before the crowd, and they had a few small fish. And having blessed them, he said that these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied, and they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people. And he sent them away and immediately got into a boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. Which you probably have a note in there in your Bible, like, we're not entirely sure where that is. It's probably in the region of Magdala, back over on the western side of the sea. So you have this feeding the 4,000 that, like, sounds an awful lot like the feeding of the 5,000. Just some details are switched. The messianic kingdom that includes people from all nations brings us really well into this feeding of the 4,000 in the Decapolis. While still in the Decapolis, which we've talked about, is a largely Gentile area but has Jewish communities, a large crowd is following him for 3 days and he has compassion on them for their hunger. And he, just like in the feeding of the 5,000, tells the disciples that he wants to feed them. Remember how the 5,000 started with him having compassion because they're like sheep without a shepherd? And he says, let's have them sit down in the green grass. We're going to feed them. It's starting like exactly the same. And again, the disciples express doubt and concern to the point of like bringing food to all these people and say they only have 7 loaves and a few small fish, which I'm pretty sure he had less last time. But after having the people sit down, he blesses the food, has the disciples pass it out, and just like last time, everybody has plenty to eat with some left over, only this time 7 baskets instead of 12. So what's the point? Some things that are very important here are the differences. First thing to notice is that Jesus has the same compassion on this crowd that is largely Gentile that he does for the crowd in Israel. It's purposely almost the same wording. The only difference is the shepherd imagery, because the shepherd is purposely picking up on the bad shepherd of Herod and what he has been doing and purposely contrasting that. So this is a largely Gentile area, and he has the same exact compassion. And significantly, this crowd, something that we might miss here, because this is often labeled the feeding of the 4,000 Gentiles, something that we might miss, though, is that this is most likely, statistically and geographically speaking, this is most likely a group composed of both Jews and Gentiles. And Jesus makes no distinction. Don't miss that. The next thing to notice is that the number of baskets of leftovers is significant in the two events, and also the type of basket. In the first feeding in Jewish territory, there are 12 baskets left over to represent the 12 tribes. As Jesus told the woman, the children are fed first. The word for basket in this feeding, in the 5,000 feeding, usually refers to a smaller basket carried by an individual. In the second miraculous feeding, though, which is to a diverse crowd, there are 7 baskets left over, and the word for basket there is a larger basket, sometimes large enough to hold a person. So why 7? 7 is the number of perfection and completion. In allusion to Genesis 1, significantly, at the very end of the previous chapter, just a couple verses prior to this, an allusion to Genesis 1 leads us into a miracle that features the number 7, just like the days of creation. Still supposed to have that on your mind. Yes, the children of Israel are fed first, but the promises, the new creation, the kingdom of God, the new Exodus, they all point to the completion and perfection, the 7 if you will, of God's plan, including people from all nations. He's catching a larger basket than people thought. This section that began in chapter 7 with the Pharisees insisting on washing hands before eating after one has interacted and come in contact with Gentiles at the market now has Jews and Gentiles eating together with no distinction. And through the imagery of the number 7, the declaration of God that it is good. This is the plan for the kingdom. And then we read in 8:11 through 21. The Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." And he left them and got into the boat again and went to the other side. I love how Mark so quickly does that. It's longer in the other accounts, so you can get more details there. But like in Mark's account, it's basically like he's in Gentile territory, he's in diverse territory, he comes back over to the Israelite side and they give him a hard time, right? He's like, "All right, I'm out." And just leaves immediately again back to the Gentile and Jewish area, or back to Gentile area, which if you read later, he goes to Bethsaida, which is on the north side. But I just love how Mark does that quick back and forth. So after going back across the Sea of Galilee to the Galilean side, Jesus is met by the Pharisees who continue to try to test him. And this time they demand a sign. Now you may be thinking, have they been blind? Like so many miracles have happened. So why on earth are they asking for a sign? But it is important that the word sign is used. They are not asking for a miracle. They've seen miracles. And in fact, they've attributed Jesus' ability to do miracles to Satan. Like, they're not arguing that he can do miracles. What they want is a sign. A sign and a miracle are different things. A sign is a promise or a declaration, a prophecy, that something is going to come to pass. And then that thing does come to pass. And specifically what they want him to do is, if you read in here, seeing from him a sign from heaven to test him. So what they want him to do is explicitly say, "I say by the command, by the word, by the power, whatever, of God, of Yahweh, this thing will happen." Because what they want to do is have him verify through the power of Yahweh that this will happen. So what, in other words, what's being tested here, why they want a sign, is that they are calling into question the power by which and the authority in which he does these miracles. To ask for a sign is to follow the Old Testament principle of verifying a prophet by having something he says actually come true. They want him to claim in God's name that something will happen and have God verify his ministry by having that thing happen. Jesus, knowing though that his ministry that he has been doing should be evidence enough, and also knowing that even if he did give them a sign, that they would still claim that he's a false prophet for going against their teachings, says that he won't give them a sign. So actually, I think it's Deuteronomy 15. There is actually a walkthrough of what you do if a prophet gives a sign that is fulfilled, but is still teaching the people astray and seems to be leading people away from God. There is a way for you to still try him as a false prophet. And Jesus sees right through them and knows, like, you're just going to Deuteronomy 15 this situation. You're just going to claim that, yes, it came true, but he's teaching against what we teach, so therefore he's wrong, and we need to still take him out. So getting back in the boat, Jesus and the disciples head toward the northern shore. On the way, the disciples realized that they'd forgotten to bring bread and only had one loaf, which, by the way, in cultural practice, the disciples would have this responsibility. Like, they were supposed to get the bread. And, like, maybe because they're so there so quickly and then leave right away, maybe they didn't have time, but, like, ultimately the responsibility falls to them. So that's why they feel this, like, oh, we don't have bread. And on the way, after they'd forgotten or realized that they'd forgotten the bread and they only had one loaf, Jesus cautions them to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of Herod. So disciples, being the disciples, usually not getting what he's giving them, they immediately begin discussing among themselves that they had no bread. Probably hearing the caution to mean that, like, well, you should be careful of where you buy bread, because they don't want you to have anything tainted by the Pharisees and Herod somehow. So they're probably like struggling with the logistics of, like, where do we get bread that's not tainted in a way that is going to offend him? Jesus, knowing their discussion, says, in my own paraphrase, "Do you really think that I'm still talking about bread? Are you that blind? None of this, in these last few events, none of this has been about bread. And you still think I'm talking about bread? If you have missed what I've been trying to say through my actions, through, yes, bread, but the actions and the imagery of the bread. If you've missed it, then your mind's eyes and ears are not working properly, and you're as blind as the religious leaders who are opposing me. He's using phrases in here. Remember how we talked back in chapter 4 about eyes and ears being closed and not hearing and not being open to receive God? He's saying, yeah, you're putting yourself in that position right now. Your ears and your eyes are closed and you're not seeing what's going on. Leaven was a common metaphor for corruption or evil that will spread. The Pharisees and Herod were hostile against Jesus, refused to see and explained away the fulfillment of promises happening right in front of them. And they both demanded a sign. We've seen the Pharisees demand a sign later, as shown specifically in Luke 23:8. We see that Herod also demands a sign. The Pharisees and Herod, they would only believe Jesus if he proved himself to them in a way of their own choosing, which they've pretty much already shown that there is no way of their own choosing that they'll even believe. They refused to see that the kingdom was arriving. They refused to see who Jesus was. And Jesus, walking the disciples back through the two feeding miracles, asks them, "Do you also not yet understand? Don't resist or be blinded to the fulfillment of the kingdom like they are being. Don't demand your own way of verifying, and don't demand it to be fulfilled in the way how you want to see it fulfilled." We're pausing purposely at 8:21. If you look forward the next few verses, you're going to see Jesus talk through the first time the plan of what's going to happen. I'm going to die and I'm going to raise again. And Peter pulls him aside and says, "No, you ain't." What did Jesus just give them a hard time about, not understanding the bread? Because don't demand that this kingdom be fulfilled in the way that you want. And then Peter goes and does the same thing a few verses later. We'll get there next week. That's part of next week's sermon. But just know that this is a perfect segue into the next section here. For this week, though, the main point that I want us to see from the text is that the Pharisees and the Jews in general had gotten so focused on keeping themselves pure and on God's promises to them that they had forgotten that the laws and the promises were never meant for just them. Brings it all the way back to Genesis 12 and the promises to all nations. You're so worried about washing hands, you've missed the whole point. To the leaders who confronted Jesus for his disciples not washing their hands after coming into contact with Gentiles, Jesus effectively says, "Wash our hands of them? No, I'm going to show you that they are just as welcome into my kingdom as you are. Just as you have missed my heart for honoring your parents, so you've also missed my heart for all people of all nations, just like Jonah did. Then and now, isolationism, seclusion, and racism have absolutely no place in us, in God's kingdom, which is meant for anyone of any place and any people of any color. We like to point out that we are the Gentiles, the non-Jews welcomed into the kingdom. But we are also too often just like the leaders and the Jews pictured here who lack God's heart, his love, and his compassion for all people around us. In our own lives, when the wrongdoing of a few in a group turns into suspicion, fear, or hate of that entire group, we as Christians must stand up and say that is wrong. In our own lives, when those we have placed in authority use racial profiling to unjustly confront, accuse, or even detain people without due process, we as Christians should stand up and say that's wrong. If your news outlets, your radio hosts, or your social media causes you to view and act towards people of different cultures, colors, or opinions than you with fear and hate, turning that group into a villainized, dehumanized them, that is wrong. We as Christians must stand up and say that's wrong. All people are made in God's image. We are called to love all people, and all people are valued and welcomed into his kingdom. As we seek to spread God's kingdom, it is we, all humans made in God's image, not us versus them. We are called to view all people as he does, as a human, as a soul that he loves. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you so much for your word. I thank you that your kingdom is bigger and greater than any one of us could ever have imagined. I thank you that you don't care where people come from. You don't care what they look like. You don't care what culture they come from. You don't care how we feel about them. That you call us to love everybody. And if we see this changing in our heart, if we see suspicion, fear, and hate coming towards anybody in our heart, that we ought to be cautious and careful and see that happening and repent of it and turn to you and have your heart for all people. I pray that in the media that we consume, in how we talk to other people, in the things that we allow ourselves to be influenced by, that we would have this check on ourselves and on our heart, that we would view the world, view people as you do. And I pray all this in your name. Amen.